welcome here today students from South Milwaukee High School. They're here with the court. Are they here? Good. They're here with the court with class program, which the court operates with the State Bar of Wisconsin. It is a national award-winning program. And the students have gotten material about this case. They have met with counsel to talk about the case, and they will meet with Justice Prosser at noon today in the courtroom. Anyone else who would like to attend, so welcome. Would the students from South Milwaukee High School please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. You'll be joined at noon by the Antigo High School and the Manitowoc Lincoln High School. Now that we have met you, I'd like to introduce the court. On my far left is Justice David Prosser. Sitting next to him is Justice Annie Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. To the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With that done, I should then also apologize to you for beginning late this morning. And I will call the first case, 98-0885, Jan v. Jerome Foods, Inc. Appearing for Prevent Goldberg is Thomas W. St. John. Mr. St. John.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Tom St. John, and I do represent the Prevent law firm. This case was certified to you by the Court of Appeals. It is an important case for the future of claims for injury in Wisconsin, because if this $3.25 million sanction against the previous Prevent law firm is upheld, it will have a definite chilling effect on the willingness of responsible trial lawyers to pursue claims that they honestly believe have merit. Prevent was found by the trial court to have commenced and continued this case in violation of both 80205 and 814025. If, in fact, the court was following the applicable law, that would mean that the court had to have determined that there was no reasonable basis in fact or law for filing this case. That's required most recently by your Juneau County decision. The court would also have had to have determined that any doubts about the reasonableness of this claim were resolved in favor of Larry Brueggemann, the attorney who was the primary attorney for the law firm. That's required under Stern. And the trial court would have had to have allowed the safe harbor that's required by the Kelly case for people who do notice pleading and immediately intend to engage in discovery to confirm the causation issue. I submit to you that that was not done in this case, that there was a huge error of law, and I'd like to address why I say that. First of all, the question is, what was known at the time this was filed? Relevant under both 80205 and 814025. Mr. Brueggemann was contacted in late 1994 by a lawyer from northern Wisconsin who he knew, who he had experiences with for 10 years, considered him to be a responsible and knowledgeable lawyer. And the lawyer told him that there was a perceived problem with chemicals in the workplace at Jerome Foods, that this lawyer was aware of 12 to 15 pregnancies that were problem pregnancies with women who had all worked there during their pregnancy and had all been exposed to CO2 and ammonia. He specifically had three women who had children born during the same year, two of them with spina bifida and one with a serious heart malformation which caused the child to die. All three had been exposed to the same chemicals at the same place. When Mr. Brueggemann got that, he also received a statement from the attorney who referred him that was taken from one of those women. That statement said that this woman's doctor, the neurosurgeon who had immediately tended to her child that was born with spina bifida, told her that this most likely happened because of the chemicals in the workplace where she worked during her pregnancy.
Now, I don't want to jump ahead, but at that point, based on what I've read, your client did not pursue what the doctor's reports were. Is that correct?
In other
words, he never, this was what the, his client said, but he never got a report from any of the doctors relating those conditions to what they said.
That there was one doctor, not
okay,
those.
Yes, the one. I should be the one doctor.
And it is correct. He did not contact that doctor before filing the complaint. He did attempt to contact him after filing the complaint. The testimony in this case, both from Mr.
When did he attempt to contact him after filing the complaint?
I'm sorry.
When did he attempt to contact that doctor after filing the complaint? What date?
I cannot tell you the specific date he
approximately.
Well, we're talking about a short period of time.
No, we're talking 10 months, counsel. Sometime in that 10-month period.
Sometime after May and before December is what I can tell you.
That's the best you can tell me?
I could look it up. But yes.
It is in the record.
It was. Yes, it is. It was not done by Mr. Brueggemann himself. It was done by Sean Crane, a lawyer in his office, and Mr. Brueggemann testified to it that the efforts were made. But I'm not going to pretend it was done before the filing of this lawsuit, which was the first test. And the answer to your question, Justice Wilcox, about why he did it, was testified to both by Mr. Brueggemann and by attorney D.J. Weiss, who is an expert in toxic tort litigation, who's called this case. And it's a fairly fundamental proposition among plaintiff's lawyers who do any kind of personal injury work. The minute you talk to a treating physician who has opined to your client that there's a problem, they see litigation, they don't want to get involved. So it is typical in this practice that you go find the experts who will first say, yes, there's a problem, and then you contact the treating physician who's already said that to the patient, and that treating physician then is not frightened away and will support it.
But in this case, just to factually get on board here with you, there was no expert. Did they find an expert?
There were three experts who were consulted by the plaintiffs at various times. One was Dr. George Dyer, who was never going to be a testimonial expert, but, as the testimony showed, was a physician and lawyer who did research on these kinds of cases and medical malpractice cases to put lawyers in touch with experts who are specific to the case.
When did they contact Dr. Dyer?
Before filing the case.
That was before. Okay.
Yes, that was before. In fact, it was Dr. Dahir.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I'm looking right at page 21 of your brief.
Sure. No. It was Dr. Dahir who told them that you need to file the case to get discovery because what you need is information on the doses that these people were subjected to. We can't get an expert to opine until he knows what the dosage was. Now, remember, everybody knew that CO2 and ammonia are toxins. The question is, what was the level of dosage here? And that couldn't come from anybody except Jerome Kuhn. So Dr. Dyer said, before I can get you an expert who's going to opine on causation here, you're going to have to get that information.
Counselor, your answer just suggested one further question, and that is, what discovery, if any, is available to you prior to filing of the complaint?
Are you telling us a general proposition?
As a general proposition,
this case?
Yes. In the state. What if I'm practicing the personal injury law, any discovery?
Well, formal discovery.
None.
Not since 1976. We had pre-pleading discovery, but when the rules were changed, and actually, Professor Clausen, who was the reporter for that, was a witness in this case and testified that that was one of the reasons that this case had to be filed, because we no longer had pre-pleading discovery. It's also why you see the reference in 802, excuse me, 05 about the representations inherent in filing pleadings with the court, that you believe them upon information and belief, which is exactly how paragraph 28, the causation paragraph in this complaint, was filed. But the other things that Mr. Brueggemann knew before filing are also significant. He knew that between April 92 and April 93, three women who had been employed by JFI gave birth to children with birth defects. But he also knew that those mothers had reported excessive amounts of ammonia and CO2 in the work environment at Jerome Foods. Now, that's supposed to be a closed refrigeration system, but they were reporting that there had been leaks. They were reporting that they had seen accumulation of CO2 on the floor. And it's not unknown that those are both toxins. They both affect the respiratory system, and at certain levels of doses have been very harmful to animals and certainly can kill human beings. But the interesting question is can they hurt the embryo? And that was what the causation issue was in this case. That had to be determined. They also knew that they had had an attorney and a librarian research both the medical records of these mothers that were their plaintiffs and the literature in the field about the causes of these kinds of injuries to see if there was some other obvious cause for three women during the same period of time in the same environment coming up with the same illnesses. And as they called it, an elimination theory, they concluded that they were there wasn't any other logical explanation for this. The last thing they had going for them is they had information. Mr. Brueggemann had been told that there was an employee at Jerome Foods who had alleged that the company knew of problems with pregnancy because of chemicals and had engaged in a cover-up. And that was a key element in Mr. Brueggemann deciding the information we're going to find here is likely to be on the inside. And one other factor, at the time they were doing this, they were a week away from the change in the joint several liability law, which was significant in this case because going in, they knew the problem here might be attributable to the people who maintain the refrigeration systems, it might be attributable to the vendors. Jerome Foods was likely to make claims against those people, and if they didn't file it before the change in the law, they would not get the benefit of the old comparative negligence.
Counsel, suppose that the change in the law was not a factor in this case. It was not eminent. Would you concede that the filing of the summons and complaint that the other information that you set forth would properly be deemed frivolous without the
Mr. Brueggemann testified that he would, in fact, have waited longer to file it if he wanted to do that. And I think that makes sense. But I think on the face of the information he had, which is what I just related to you, particularly a statement from a treating physician that it did cost this, I think he was right to file. I also point out, 80205 is our state equivalent to Rule 11. Rule 11 specifically provides that among the factors in determining whether something is frivolous is the time available to make the decision to file. Now, historically, that's referring to when you're running up against statutes of limitations. But in reality, given the fact that in Wisconsin, that law he was bumping up against was being referred to as a lawyer's malpractice vehicle, meaning you don't file a case that you believe in before that statute, you've engaged in malpractice. That essentially was the equivalent of a lawyer's statute of limitations, and it was a major factor. When they filed, they did exactly what Dr. Dahir said. They started discovery. The biggest problem in the discovery and getting the documents was there was a fight, and I'm not saying who's at fault at this, but Jerome legitimately did not want to turn over documents without some degree of confidence that they would not be distributed. So a confidentiality agreement became important. It wasn't effected until December 7th. After the confidentiality agreement was in place, representatives from the Previon firm went to Jerome and looked at these 200,000 documents that were put out there, which is an entirely different issue, but looked at it for a couple of days and went back, and Dr. Dahir talked to another expert, Mr. Brueggemann talked to another expert. Both of them said, on the basis of the information you have, we will be subject to serious cross-examination on making the ruling. And it was at that point in February, 9 months after this case was filed, that Mr. Brueggemann decided the only way, and those experts also told him, if you do want to make that connection, the way to do it with this is with an epidemiologist, because you're going to have to study the incidence of these things in the workplace. Very expensive proposition. Mr. Brueggemann talked to his clients. His clients agreed, we don't have the heart to pursue this. So in February, they announced they wanted to voluntarily dismiss this case. That was the expanse of this litigation. But in that discovery, because there's also an allegation that this was continued frivolously, In that discovery, which couldn't be done until December, there were some additional things that were determined. The documents they found in JFI's records indicated, among other things, that when ammonia and CO2 were admitted into the environment at JFI, workers had become ill. That JFI was concerned enough about the cause of the plaintiff's birth defects, two of the very three people that Larry Grugman represented. The year before, they'd done their own investigation of this because they too thought this raised a question. The JFI files showed that in 1993, JFI had investigated spina bifida and carbon dioxide and the effects of carbon dioxide on birth. The research there, among the documents they found was a carbon dioxide safety fact sheet for JFI employees that contained the language, concentrations over 50,000 parts per million can deplete oxygen levels, which could impact the health of unborn children. They found out that during an ammonia leak in 1993, which is a very relevant period of time for these children, pregnant women were not allowed back into the facility. In other words, they kept finding information that JFI had the same concerns that gave rise to this litigation. But despite that, they decided they were not going to put on some expert who would be weak on making the connection because of the parts, and they decided to go to epidemiology and didn't do it.
Counsel, I appreciate you staying with these facts, and I think we'll stay with them for quite a while, at least as far as I'm concerned. It's a very fact-intensive case. And I'm very concerned about what it was that that Brueggemann did after the filing of the complaint with respect to establishing causation, and when did he do it? I know that your brief puts this in terms of whether or not, primarily in terms of whether or not you had adequate cause to file the complaint. I go beyond that. I may well agree that you had adequate cause to file the complaint, but I may find that you didn't take steps promptly enough to get it, and 10 months was too long. So I'm interested in that. When did he start contacting experts? When did he try to find experts? And then I'm particularly interested in your response to the finding of fact number 74, that there was an untruthful representation with respect to one of the Mr. Brueggemann stating that that he had an expert that established causation.
Remember, he was using Dr. Dahir to find the experts, and by the way, our belief, my client's belief at the time, is that the appropriate expert, before they realized that it would require an epidemiologist, was a toxicologist. Dr. Dahir had said, you can't get him, we'll talk to him when we've got the dosage information. When they got the dosage information, they could do it. That was the significance about this confidentiality. All they could do is get documents from the company, but they couldn't get the documents from the company until December.
But they didn't need documents to establish causation, did they, between alcohol and CO2 and spina bifida? That's an expert, or ammonia.
What they were looking at in addition is what other information was there. And yes, there was other information out there that showed in animal studies high concentrations of CO2 had caused both spinal defects and heart problems.
There was information. Did they contact any experts?
And that's why they needed to know doses. It was at high dose levels. The connections had not been made. If I could make an analogy, what they were looking at is probably what you would have seen in a lung cancer case against a cigarette company 10 years ago. Every one of those cases was the same way. We never broke down. The state of Wisconsin didn't get its $5 billion until people got into the records of R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company and found out what was going on. That's the same theory here.
But counsel, there was a finding of fact or a conclusion that you should have established contact and established causation with an expert prior to filing of the complaint. That's what Judge Brunner said. I don't necessarily agree with that. But I'm trying to find out from this line of questioning, when did you first contact an expert?
First contact with an expert was Dr. Dahir before filing.
Right.
The next contact with any expert that would have been relevant to this topic was after we were able to get in the documents. When we got the information about dosage and found what was in there, Dr. Dahir talked to one expert, Mr. Brueggemann talked to another one. Both of them said, you will need to have more than this. Epidemiological study, and at that point they said we're dismissing the case.
Let me just ask you, your position is you didn't want to get an expert until you knew what the dosage was, because the expert would say, hey, was it a smidgen or was it a lot and over what time?
That is
correct. Assuming that from what you say. Okay. On June 21, you served a notice of deposition on an officer, right?
I believe that's correct, Dave.
And on, they refused to produce the documents.
That's correct.
Without a confidentiality agreement, and the order was signed on December 7th. So between June 21 and December 7th, what documents or what did you see?
Nothing.
You didn't get anything from
JFI? No. What was being done at that time was other research, additional research on medical causes and things outside of it. But that is what we needed.
Okay, but they didn't give it to you between June 21 and December 7th.
No.
Is that right?
That's correct.
And then they produced over 200,000 documents for inspection.
They built a room for those documents.
And it cost $4,000, if I remember the brief. Okay. And then on January 31 to February 1, you looked at those documents, or somebody?
Sean Crane.
Mr. Crane looked at those documents.
Correct.
And then at what time did you seek to dismiss the complaint?
The end of February, around the 27th.
So that within a month after you saw the documents, you wanted out.
Saw the documents, consultations with two more experts about what they meant, learned that it would require an epidemiological study, and voluntarily dismissed the case.
And in the meantime, JFI had served interrogatories on you.
Correct, and conducted, I believe, three depositions.
Okay, and then your brief says, in July 95, JFI formed a belief that there was no literature and no experts who could support a finding of causation.
Well,
who testified to that?
Dr. Brent. When in the sanctions hearing, which now took place in 1997 and resulted in a decision in 1998, we heard all the testimony of the expert that they had retained who they had not disclosed to us. And I understand they retained him in July of 1995, July of 1996, and had gotten opinions from him that this couldn't possibly be possible. I'm afraid the trial judge believed that that was the ultimate overwhelming conclusion in this case without any contrary opinions. And it shows up through his opinion. I mean, getting to the merits of this, if you look at everything that justifies what the judge did in this case, he says, because we didn't have Dr. Brent on our side, we were frivolous, that there's no possible way. Well, there's never been a determination like that. Dr. Brent, by the way, happens to be the same guy who doesn't agree with the Food and Drug Administration banning cyclamates. He said he has told hundreds of people in his lifetime, pregnant women who have come to him with claims from geneticists that they're going to have deformed children, don't believe that geneticist. And I mean, no, he is the world's greatest expert in his own mind.
But if that was in July 95, how much of the billing here that you're being asked to pay, if JFI found out in July 95, that your claim had no merit and was frivolous, that's what JFI, how much money did they put in after July 95?
Most of it.
So they thought you were frivolous and they continued on.
Yeah, and you know, under Rule 11, they would have had a requirement when they had any opinion that said they thought it was frivolous to tell us that and give us 20 days notice
tell
to drop
Rule 11 is that that's the federal rule.
That's the federal
rule. What's the Wisconsin?
80205 is based on Rule 11, and we are supposed to follow the logic of federal cases under Rule 11 and interpreting it. Now, Rule 11 specifically has a requirement in it now, I think since 1993, that you must give notice if you think the other side is acting in violation of that rule so they can cure their conduct. That isn't in our law, but before it was in Rule 11, that was the case law. That justices and the courts of appeals looked at these and they said, you know, to be fair here, you can't sandbag people. You can't sit there and say, I know they don't have a case. Let them go through this, generate your own defense fees, and then come back and say, now you have to pay me on this. And if I just may, two other things. Remember, there was also a safe place statute claim here. which in and of itself has a presumption of causation, which was filed. And the other thing, I do want to answer your question about Mr. Rubin's integrity, because that has been bothering him. It came up to me before. He said, 30 years ago, I never thought I'd be here on something like this. It was a conversation that took place in Milwaukee after a hearing on a change of venue. Mr. Brueggemann's testimony was that in this conversation, he was asked whether he had an expert, and he said he's not prepared to talk about that. He'll disclose it when the scheduling order says so. Mr. Smith said, Mr. Brueggemann lied to me and told me he had an expert in place. I'm not going to tell you that Mr. Smith didn't honestly believe that, but the evidence that was contemporaneous with that was a memo to the file that Mr. Brueggemann prepared. Say that's self-serving, but it was contemporaneous, and it did say, I told him I wouldn't disclose that now. The other thing that proves it is at the hearing in this case, the vice president of the company, Jerome, was testifying. He was asked what was reported back to him after that meeting, and he reported back that the lawyers for Jerome that were at that meeting told him that Mr. Brueggemann would not disclose where he had an expert.
So
the finding in this case that Mr. Brueggemann lied is not only offensive to Mr. Brueggemann, it is completely without factual support.
Was there any testimony presented to the contrary when you had the sanctions hearing?
Yes. Mr. Brueggemann testified to the contrary, showed the memo. Mr. Gleichert, in his own testimony, was asked what he was told, and he did not say that those lawyers from our company came back after this hearing and said, Mr. Brueggemann told us they had an expert. He reported Mr. Brueggemann would not tell us that he had an expert.
Well, who drafted these findings?
The lawyers for JFI. There was only, I think there were only two changes in the findings, both at the end, and I think they both had to do with the amount of the sanctions. And by the way,
did you object to these findings?
I wasn't in this case until after the judgment was entered.
Was there an objection?
I would assume they were objected to before we got in. By the way, last topic on that, neither one of these statutes is a fee-shifting statute. Neither one of these statutes says if you are found to have acted frivolously that the other side is entitled to all of their attorney's fees. It is a reasonable sanction if, in fact, there is something, not whatever these people claim they put in the case.
If I can stay on finding of fact 74 for just one more question. Did, at the hearing in front of Judge Bruner, did the attorney for the other side testify? I think he said his name was Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith is sitting right here.
Right. Did he testify that, in fact, Mr. Brueggemann told him this?
Yes.
Now, what do we do with respect to this finding of fact, then, if it's a matter of credibility?
Should I also point out something else? At the beginning of that hearing in front of Judge Bruner, there was an objection to Mr. Smith participating because they thought he might be a witness. And he represented to Judge Bruner he would only testify as to the value of services. And then at the end of the hearing, he was the last witness and he got up and testified that Larry Brueggemann told him that he had an expert way back when they were in the motion stage. Yes, it is a matter of credibility. Yes, that is a factor in it. But you can find clear error if the facts are such, the objective facts are such, that that is an unreasonable conclusion from what was there. And given the fact that their own vice president testified as to what was reported to him after that hearing, and Mr. Brueggemann had a contemporaneous note, I think Mr. Brueggemann's testimony is entitled to much more weight than that. My time is up, I thank you.
Mr. St. John, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cruz, you're going to introduce Mr. Smith.
Okay, please, the board. I am Jim Trupas of Michael Best and Friedrich, and it is my pleasure today to introduce and ask that the court to allow Mr. James Smith to argue this matter on behalf of Jerome Foods. Mr. Smith is a 1983 graduate of Temple University. He is a member in good standing of the Pennsylvania Bar, as well as the Bar of the United States Supreme Court and the Third Circuit Court of Appeals and numerous federal district courts. He is a partner in the firm of Blank, Rome, Comiskey, and McCauley in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and he has acted for many years as litigation counsel to Jerome Foods, and I move his admission for the purpose of making this oral argument today.
Motion's granted. Thank you. Welcome to Madison and Miss Madison.
Several days of testimony at an evidentiary hearing, the circuit court issued 118 findings of fact and 74 conclusions of law, in which that court found that the Prevent firm was not reasonable, when they started the lawsuit, and not reasonable as they continued the lawsuit for its 10 months pendency. I respectfully submit to the court today that the evidence that supports those 118 findings of fact is overwhelming, and that the 74 conclusions of law contained in the trial court's decision are well-founded. I would respectfully ask this court to affirm the circuit court's decision in all respects. Affirming the circuit court's decision today will uphold and vindicate a long-standing policy as it's embodied in Wisconsin Statute 802.05, and 814.025 that requires that lawsuits have a reasonable basis. Enforcing this policy won't deter legitimate litigation. Rather, upholding the trial court's decision will send a message to all lawyers, whether they represent the wealthy or whether they represent the disadvantaged, to be prepared. To be prepared that if on inquiry from this court or inquiry from any other court, that they will have to demonstrate that their conduct and that their complaints and that their pleadings have a reasonable basis. It seems to me that today isn't the day to continue the debate, factual debate, that went on before the circuit court. The day to argue about which witness to believe or which evidence to accept, I respectfully submit to this court, has passed. The question today, in my mind, is whether or not those 118 findings of fact that Judge Bruner found, whether or not any of those findings of fact were clearly erroneous.
Well, let me tell you what bothers me.
Yes.
If you're right that this was frivolous on initiation, frivolous in continuation for 10 months, which is a relatively short time in a life of a lawsuit, especially a plaintiff's lawsuit of this nature. If you're right, then why aren't your defenses frivolous? And why isn't your expenditure of huge sums of money and they're frivolous? Because if it's frivolous, you ought to have known that. You ought to have sat back and said, hey, it's frivolous. We don't have to do much. And we got all the records. We've gone through ammonia. We've gone through carbon dioxide. We know, we've investigated all this. In fact, you should have just defended this initially on frivolous. You delayed in serving an answer, right?
No, ma'am.
Well, didn't you, when did you answer this?
We answered the case promptly.
And did you file a third-party claim?
Yes, we did.
Against the mothers and the suppliers?
Yes.
Was that frivolous?
No, it was not.
Why not?
At the time, as we learned what it would take to assert a claim on embryonic development dealing with spina bifida, there had to be some sort of exposure during the first trimester. That, to us, signaled many questions in our mind, legal questions in our mind, about whether or not the fetuses themselves during a period of time when the court has determined that viability doesn't exist can constitute freakers. Chief Justice, this lawsuit was enormous. This wasn't an everyday lawsuit. This lawsuit, based upon the findings of fact of this court, or the findings of fact of the lower court, threatened the very viability of the company.
But only if it was, if it had a reasonable basis.
You're right.
And yeah. So, if it was so threatening to you, you had to have thought that there may have been a reasonable basis. Now, you are the people that have all the records. You're the people that put out ammonia and carbon dioxide. You have checked this, I mean, assuming that discovery is right. So, why don't you have a reasonable basis? You think there's a reasonable basis to defend. Why don't they have a reasonable basis to sue?
I'm prepared to answer that question, and I'd like to. My response is twofold. The first response focuses on what the Previn firm did. And I'm mindful that I am a guest in this courtroom. And in making statements about opposing counsel, I'll only stick to not what I believe the fair inferences are, but I'll invite the court's attention to what the trial court said, the adjectives and verbs that were used to describe what the trial court said about the Previn firm's conduct. As this court has already acknowledged.
Counsel, you're not answering my question.
Well,
I'm asking you why your defenses weren't frivolous.
Because they continued to advise us right up until the end, Chief Justice, right up until February of 1996 that the lawsuit had burned. They said it in documents. The court made specific findings of fact and conclusions of law indicating that they misled us, lied, indicating that they gave false answers to interrogatories, indicating that they made misleading statements and pleadings, all to continue the lawsuit.
When did they answer the interrogatories?
The answers to interrogatories were given, I have it here, and I believe it was August of 1996. We served them immediately upon getting the complaint. We asked them the core question that's at the heart of the dispute today, which is, what is the basis for paragraph 28? The basis for paragraph 28, as the trial court found, made specific findings, had nothing to do with what the dosage was. The basis for paragraph 28 concerns science. I would respectfully submit to the court.
Can you refresh me? Paragraph 28 in the complaint says.
Paragraph 28 of the complaint says that each of the defects is causally related to exposure to CO2 and ammonia. It's the core allegation of the case. We asked them right at the start of the case. The court made specific findings of fact and conclusions of law. I could read them. That though the answers that were given to that interrogatory was false and evasive. And that falsity and that evasiveness, the court specifically found, continued until February of 1995, when again, opposing our motion to get an answer to those interrogatories, the Previn firm again said that we won't be prejudiced by the continuation of this lawsuit. Because, in fact, they'll make their expert available. When they filed that document, they knew they didn't have an expert. When they filed that document, the court found they knew that the experts that they tried weren't going to back them up, but yet, nonetheless, they continued it.
So what paragraphs are you referring to specifically in the findings?
Findings of fact 74, conclusion of law 45, 47, 48, 50. There are specific findings in there. So the reason why we defended the lawsuit was because if you look at what Mr. Brueggemann said, his memo to the file, he told me in the hallway, not by my testimony, but by his own admission, he says in his memo, I told them I had a viable case. There's no dispute between my testimony and Mr. Gleichert's. The court found that statement wasn't truthful. The court also observed about Mr. Brueggemann. The court said that if you read the record, it says, while Mr. Brueggemann was testifying, the court specifically says he gave credibility to the old adage that lawyers make bad witnesses. There was ample evidence to support the finding. But I'd like if I could...
You know what, we're talking at cross purposes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's probably my fault. You're talking about whether this particular plaintiff in this particular law firm had no reasonable basis to initiate the suit. And my question to you, to the defendant, is really your position is no plaintiff would have had reasonable basis to sue you on this complaint. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
So your position is, on its face, regardless of what happened, regardless of what they had, this is frivolous because your firm, when I say your firm, Jerome Inc., knew or had very good reason to know on the basis of its own research and its own documentation that no one could really sue you and do well, that is, get a causation on ammonia and carbon dioxide. Isn't that right?
No.
Why not?
Our position, Chief Justice, is that this lawsuit was frivolous because the law required them to have a reasonable basis. It's those six bases that I put up for the court's review where they had nothing. The court went through each one of those alleged bases and found that none of them, considered individually or collectively, constituted a reasonable basis, and I could cite to you the many findings of fact behind each one.
Could anybody have a reasonable basis to sue you this complaint?
It seems to me on this complaint, if there was a reasonable basis, it would have to be something. The Prevyant firm had absolutely nothing. And what compounded that problem is that not only did they have nothing, but the court specifically found that all of those bases, and I can cite to each finding of fact, and there are numerous ones that go to each of the bases, the court carefully considered each one of them and carefully rejected each one of them and said, well, not only did you have nothing when you started, but then you engaged in misleading conduct to cover up the fact that you didn't have anything.
Is it your position, counsel, that it was necessary to have an expert on causation before the filing of the summons and complaint?
I think that in this case, if that's all they had, then they had to go and consult with a qualified expert, Justice.
So your position in this case is that failure to have an expert on causation before the filing of the summons and complaint was frivolous?
In this case, given that they had nothing else, given that there was nothing else, Justice, my position is that had they gone, and it's not my position, it's the trial court's specific finding of fact, which says, had they gone and talked to a qualified person, that they would have realized that a 4 to 5 hour consultation.
Okay, but so the answer to my question is, it is your position that failure to have an expert on causation before the filing of a summons and complaint constitutes frivolousness.
In this case, on these facts, Justice, yes.
Well, counsel, you heard opposing counsel say that they wanted to get the documentation, which, of course, they did not get, as I understand, until December. How do you face that when they needed these documents and they were advised by Dr. Dyer that this is necessary in order to form an opinion?
I have a multitude of responses. One is that the court specifically found that no weight should be given to the testimony of Dr. Dahir. No weight. In addition to that, the court specifically found that there was no reason to get the documents because the documents weren't going to tell them what they needed to know. What they needed to know was, regardless of whatever the exposure was, does the science support the claim? So there was nothing that they could have learned. The court also specifically found, as a matter of fact, that all of those documents, if all they wanted were the exposure documents, they didn't have to file a lawsuit to get them. All they had to do was exercise their rights under OSHA and send the employees into the plant and ask for the documents if they didn't want to follow OSHA. All of the records that they said they needed, they could have had before the lawsuit.
Was it frivolous for them not to get OSHA documents before the filing of a summons complaint? Does such action constitute frivolousness in your opinion?
It was unreasonable, and therefore frivolous.
Or frivolous for them not to get the OSHA documents
before
the filing.
And Justice, may I add, that the record also indicates that when they had the records, they never showed them to the in-state and out-of-state consultant who they refused to tell us whose name it was. So the suggestion that they needed the records to go show the consultant isn't what the findings of fact are. The findings of fact are they never got those records and showed them to their experts. They didn't, and it's clear why. They didn't need to show them to their experts. And what it points up is all they had to do was go and talk to a qualified person before they filed the lawsuit. And as the court made specific findings of fact, going back to the multiple pregnancies, the court specifically found that had they talked to a qualified person, that the very information that they thought helped their case hurt their case. In findings of fact number 20 and 88, that it counseled against the presence of a syndrome. With respect to the research into medical literature, the suggestion today that there's medical literature, that's not what the court found. The court said in its opinion, Dr. Brent's uncontested testimony that the literature is not simply silent in the area, but in fact, ample studies which are known to teratologists find that there is no relationship with the chemicals used by Jerome in these birth defects. The court found Dr. Brent's testimony to be impressive and found that the individuals who did that medical research were not qualified. In findings of fact number 21, they had no medical training. They had no scientific credentials. In finding of fact number 77, that the conclusion that these unqualified people reached was just wrong.
And did your client find Dr. Brent credible and persuasive?
Yes.
When did they get his opinion?
In July.
July of 95?
Yes.
And how much of your expenses were after July of 95?
The bulk of them, Chief Justice.
And how do you justify that?
I justify that by inviting the court to the memo to the file, which is part of the reproduced record, Mr. Brueggemann's memo to the file, and I'd like to read it to the court. The Philadelphia lawyers indicated that their client...
Can you put this in context for us?
Sure.
Memo to the file.
I'm sorry. I beg your pardon, Justice. In July, I appeared with Mr. Trufas to argue a motion to transfer a venue in Milwaukee. We're going to oppose the motion. The court transferred the case. There was no basis to bring the lawsuit in Milwaukee. Outside, the findings of fact support this. I was under instructions to find out what the basis was, and to put counsel on notice about the enormity that we perceive this lawsuit, about the expense that it was going to cause us. And I'll read to you the memo from Mr. Brueggemann, which he thinks vindicates. The lawyers indicated that their client, quote, has invested a great deal of money in research and development and is just astounded to see that this case has arisen. However, they may have overlooked something. If we have proof of a causal connection, their client would like to see the proof and bring the matter to an early settlement if there's a basis for a settlement. I informed the Philadelphia lawyers that we did some preliminary investigation and we felt we had a viable case. And I'll stop there. We had a viable case. What he told us was he had a viable case. We had carefully researched what the threshold was for an expert's opinion in Wisconsin. We knew that Daubert's not recognized in this jurisdiction, and we knew that there's a lower threshold for the admissibility of an expert. So that's why we kept asking him, tell us who your expert is. What is it that you have to support the core allegation in the case and the unrefuted findings of fact and the conclusions of law indicated not only that they not told us, but that they misled us. And that in and of itself.
You were misled when plaintiff's counsel said that he had a viable case.
He did there, and in other instances. The court specifically found, Chief Justice, in findings of fact 7446, 48, 49, 50, I could read them to you if you'd like. The court specifically used words like concealed, misleading, false, evasive. They're in the findings of fact by the court. That's what they did to us during the 10 months that we attempted to pursue them. And with respect to the documents, I would ask the court to bear in mind that we didn't delay producing the documents until December. They gave to us a massive document request. And I would submit to the court I have it. Having been told by a lawyer as reputable as Mr. Brueggemann that he had a viable case, there was no basis for me to object to documents that virtually went to all the documents in our facility. documents dealing with how ventilation was done, documents dealing with all mothers, documents that reached back 18 years to women who had problems with pregnancy. We produced the documents. We offered to produce those documents, starting, it's in the file, findings of fact by the court, starting on November 10th. That's after we did the responsible thing, which was to gather them, make sure there was a complete production, to organize the documents and produce them in the manner that was required by the rules of procedure here in Wisconsin. There's no dispute that we did that. During that period of time, we were filing a motion attempting to force Mr. Brueggemann to disclose what it was that was the basis for his lawsuit. And as the court found, he was filing responses and attempting to thwart that. And at the court's words, conceal, mislead, not truthful, that's what went on in this case. That's what this case is about. In the face of a lawsuit that would have bankrupted this company. Now, with respect to how did we spend so much money, Chief Justice, I'll say to you today that if we submitted a bill for $700,000 for three depositions, I wouldn't beat your own foolish lawyer. That's not what happened in this case. And again, I invite the court back to the findings of fact and the conclusions of law from the court. We itemized each aspect of the representation. And our expert came in, unlike any other expert or any expert from the other side, our expert, a respected lawyer in Wisconsin, reviewed what we did. We did an independent investigation, an internal investigation. It's itemized. Everything is itemized. Every one of our bills is in a binder that's a part of this court's record. Everything we did. We put insurance companies on notice. No insurance company agreed to provide insurance in this case. A case of this magnitude where we were accused of killing and maiming babies. A case where a reputable lawyer was telling the court, not just me, that he had an expert. We fought the insurance companies. We wanted to get insurance backup for the company. With respect to the internal investigation, we were accused. The company employs 2,600 individuals. A respected lawyer said that we were responsible for killing and injuring babies. Of course we did an internal investigation. And the investigation didn't simply conclude what we thought, but during the course of the investigation, we went back and we retraced where these individuals were during the period of time. Bear in mind, this is a facility that it has hundreds of thousands of square feet.
This was before July?
This was thereafter. It was thereafter.
But not an expert witness that told you. Couldn't have done this. And then you went back and traced.
But they had an expert who said that he could. And that's what makes the lawsuit, Chief Justice. And we took the lawyer at his word. And then we filed pleadings in the courthouse. Pleadings that the trial court found to be false, basically misleading.
Can you give me an example from the interrogatories that the court found was misleading? Because I have not read the interrogatories.
The first set of interrogatories that were served for June, reproduced record number 132. The interrogatory states, with respect to the allegations contained in paragraph 28 of your complaint, that, quote, upon information and belief, said physical defects were caused in utero by the exposure of their mothers to poisonous chemicals emitted from one of the aforesaid food processing machines. I'll jump down to part B. Justice. B. State each fact or other basis upon which you contend that the physical defects were causally related, as asserted in paragraph 28. C. Identify each authority, or source upon which you rely to support this assertion that the above birth defects were causally related to exposure to poisonous chemicals, as described above, including, without limitation, physicians, experts, and medical treatises or articles. To part B, the answer that was given was, plaintiffs object to this interrogatory on the grounds that it calls for expert testimony. Plaintiffs will disclose experts and provide summary of their testimony in accordance with the pretrial order. Thereafter, plaintiffs will make the expert witnesses available for deposition, provided that the defendants will agree to pay the charges of said witness for deposition.
So what's the matter with that?
There was no experts. The court specifically found that this was state the factual basis. Tell us what facts you have.
So you when you answer that, you should have said, I have no experts. That
I have no facts. Or I have no basis. Or that's my basis. And they never told us that. They never told us that. In fact, what they said, consistent with what was said in the hall, was that he had an expert. He just wouldn't identify it. And that's what Mr. Bleicher's testimony was. You can harmonize all of it. What Bleicher testified to, and I'd ask the court to go back and read it, is he just wouldn't tell us who the expert was. That's a fair reading, and that's consistent, and that's why the finding of fact number 74 is not clearly erroneous. I could cite other examples if you want me to. Justice, I'd also like to bring to your attention, if I could, what they said.
You have 5 minutes.
Startled me for a second. What they said in February, when they filed the brief. When they filed the brief in response to our motion to compel, I quote from the brief that was filed. You'll just indulge me for one moment. Previan's brief said, this was filed on February 13th, 10 months later, JFI cannot be said to be prejudiced if the answers to the contention interrogatories are deferred, since the plaintiffs will make their expert witnesses available for deposition pursuant to the dictates of the scheduling order. That's in February. That's after they talked to these in-state and out-of-state consultants. They didn't have an expert to tell us. They were misleading us, which is exactly what the court concluded. Exactly what the court concluded.
It's in February of
1996, Justice Bandler, it's approximately 10 months.
This is just before they filed their motion for dismissal?
It's approximately 2 weeks or 10 days or so before they moved to dismiss. They were still making reference to an expert, even though they knew by then they didn't have one. They didn't have one. And before we filed this motion, it's in the record, the court specifically found, we gave them every opportunity. We said we'd be delighted to dismiss this lawsuit because we don't like it. But by the way, we've been looking at the rules here. What was the basis to bring them in the first place? Would you please tell us? All the letters are in there. All the letters where we wrote it said, please tell us. And they wrote back and continued to say that they had a basis when in fact they never did.
Counsel, in reading, and I've read and reread the trial court's opinion.
Yes.
And it just seems to have such a different flavor than the findings of fact, conclusions of law. In the, I think, 12 pages of the opinion, or 13, I guess, it consistently talks about the problem is no causal nexus can be established. That's at page 3. The court states, the real problem here doesn't have to do with ethics. People are nice people, in essence, it says. It finds that the law firm made an error in judgment in filing this case on page 7 without a sound basis in fact for the causal nexus between the birth defects and Jerome Foods' operation. Several pages emphasize the problem here is in the filing of a lawsuit without causation, without an expert.
May I respond?
I guess I find a different flavor in this opinion from the findings of fact. The opinion says no problem of ethics, exemplary career, not saying anything was wrong about the person, not saying it's a bad attorney. It's rather didn't have an expert. And I'm not sure that's frivolous in this case.
Well, the court also said in his opinion, and I quote from page 10, the filing of an action without such an investigation, I believe, is reckless.
Reckless. And frivolous.
The court also made reference to filing a lawsuit in terms of balancing the interest. The court made reference to unethical conduct. The same themes, Justice Bradley, find their way in the memorandum into the findings of fact and conclusions of law, all of which are resoundingly supported by the record.
Yeah, he seemed to just really be gripping that there wasn't an expert on causation before the filing in this case. That's what really bothered him.
Because if you go back and look at all of the bases that they claimed, an expert would have told them to the extent that he gave weight to any of them, he gave no weight to the document. But if you gave, if you, to the extent that the trial court gave way to any of the explanations, he said if you would have talked to someone who knew that they were talking about, what they were talking about, they would have told you that none of this, it actually points to the opposite conclusion. The medical records. They had someone review the medical records who didn't know anything about the medical records and concluded through this, quote, elimination analysis, that it pointed to a conclusion of a symptom. In fact, there was plenty of information in the medical records which suggested that the cause for the problems with these children was no more than what was in the medical documents themselves. They had risk factors. They just didn't know how to read them. Mr. Brueggemann, when he testified, he didn't even know who looked at the medical records. He didn't know how long they were looked at. He didn't know when they were looked at. It was all part of the unreasonable conduct. If I could, I'd like to touch on Senate Bill 11. There were
got about a minute. You've read my
I'll move quickly. There are specific findings of fact I would invite the court to, 31, 32, 33, and 90. The court finds in there that there was plenty of time. This wasn't a question where they had a week. They had plenty of time. They had at least 2.5 months in order to evaluate their case, and they could have. I'd like to, if I could, in closing, just touch on public policy. It seems to me that they're not made or considered in a vacuum. That surely no one could be heard to say that the interests of vindicating public policy, the courtroom open to the indigent, or to keep the courtroom open to the indigent, that the court should, or any court should, tolerate attorneys who file false and misleading pleadings. I would submit to the court that what went on here was egregious. It was egregious from the start, it was egregious through the middle, and it was egregious at the end. You see, members of the court, this is not a case where lawyers were misled into taking imprudent action. It's not a case where discovery could have cured a fundamental problem that plagued the lawsuit. It's also not a case where lawyers set on a trail to develop a new theory of liability, but were thwarted by an evidentiary barrier. That's not this case. What this case is about, as found in those 118 findings of fact and conclusions of law, is that this is a case where lawyers were inattentive, they were careless, and they didn't follow the rules. And it seems to me that the public policy here that we should vindicate, there are several, is to protect innocent people and companies from frivolous lawsuits. That's one. To let lawyers know that they will be held accountable if they engage in this kind of conduct. I see that my time is up. I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. St. John, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Just as an aside on something that was said, there's a question about OSHA. There was a check of OSHA records, but you need to understand that the only thing OSHA records will show in a situation like this is what was required to be reported to them under their standards, assuming that this was. Assuming that something was, the company did follow the standards, and we're not suggesting they weren't. Justice Bradley, your question is the right one, and the answer is even tougher. Under this decision, not only do you have to have an expert on causation before filing this case to be reasonable, you have to have Dr. Brent as your expert. This judge concluded...